I'm Terry Thornton, curator of education here at the Modern. It's my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. This is an ongoing series. I think most of you are probably familiar with the series. It happens in the fall and again in the spring. And we've had a great run. I can hardly believe this is our next to the last one for this fall season. So we will end next week with the British-Canadian painter Tony Sherman. Beautiful, intense, very serious paintings. I encourage you again to look them up. I love that you have access to these people before you come now with the web. But or the internet. But he will be here again. He will be our last Tuesday evening for the fall season, but we will begin again in February. So I encourage again for all of you to get on our website and check out that schedule as soon as it's posted, which should be by December. I think you're safe to check out that the schedule for the spring. I also wanted to remind those of you that aren't familiar with this program, you know that you come in, you get your ticket, that reserves you a seat. It is free. It's always been free. Let's hope it always stays free. And then the galleries are open on Tuesday evenings during the run of the lecture series. So take advantage. Go in and see the new Susan Rothenberg exhibition, see the permanent collection. It's been reinstalled on either side of the Rothenberg exhibition upstairs, so there are a lot of new things to see, so I hope you'll take advantage of that. I also hope you'll take advantage of the graduate student lecture program. Every Tuesday during the run of the lecture series, a graduate student gives a gallery talk, a very focused gallery talk, and they've been fantastic, so I encourage you to come next week to the last one of those as well. Tonight, we have the innovative and courageous William Lamson here from Brooklyn, and I think you'll understand those adjectives if you don't already as the night progresses and you see his work and hear what he has to say. There are other adjectives such as thoughtful, curious, observant, clever, but I'll let you come up with your own as you hear Will talk about his work tonight. What I'll do is I'll just fill you in on where Will came from and where he's been in recent years, what he's been doing. He was born in Arlington, Virginia. He has a BA from Dartmouth College and an MFA from Bard. He has actively shown his work since receiving his BA in 2000 with solo exhibitions in Philadelphia, Denver, Leipzig, Germany, Seattle, Sydney, Australia, and Cape Town, South Africa, just to name a few of the locations. His solo exhibition, Automatic, just opened at Marty Walker Gallery in Dallas and runs through November 14th. You will see that work here tonight, but I highly recommend making the drive to Dallas for the drawings, if nothing else. They aren't quite the same when they're blown up here on the screen, but they are really quite beautiful and telling in person, so I encourage you to do that. Other solo exhibitions this year include Work and Trade at Pierogi in Brooklyn, of which Michael Wilson writes in Art Forum, few artists would claim total control over what they produce. But in Work and Trade, his third solo exhibition at Pierogi, William Lamson assigns Chance a leading role. So again, the adjective courageous. Also, an upcoming exhibition of very recent work, some of which I think is still in progress, and I've had great fun listening to him tell me about today, opens at Art Space in New Haven, New York. And I don't have the dates for that, so maybe Will will tell us about that as well. Group exhibitions are also vast, including most recently Destroy Everything, which is showing this year in Grandia, Spain. And then Will was one of the artists in the 2008 New American Talent exhibition that some of you are familiar with at Art House in Austin. And just to name, again, a few, but looking back at Ground Zero, images from the Brooklyn Museum collection, as well as Think Twice, Young American Photography, which showed in a gallery in Milan, Italy, those both being in 2007. Will's work is and some very impressive public collections, some that you would be familiar with and are close to home, the Dallas Museum of Art, as I mentioned already, of course, the Brooklyn Museum of Art, and then the MFA in Houston. He has justifiably received a good bit of attention from the press, with the Village Voice recently citing Will in the article, New York artist you probably don't know but should. So I guess we'll be saying we knew him when. In his artist statement, Will explains, "I explore culturally glorified narratives from the perspective of the amateur, who is motivated by love for the activity and a desire to achieve." And I'm chopping this up a bit for my own purposes, but he goes on to say, "In the resulting work, human struggle becomes a central component. My work addresses the universality of human struggle, the universality of human struggle, and how we create meaning through it." I skipped around quite a bit and left some out, so if that didn't read clearly, don't hold Will responsible. But I just wanted you to know that it is, these are some of the reasons that I wanted Will to come to the Modern and talk about his work, because I want to know more about this. So please join me in welcoming William Lampson.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Terry, and for having me here today. And thank you guys for taking time off this like lovely summer evening in Fort Worth to come out. Can we drop the lights? Awesome. All right, so I'm going to start with my thesis project from Bard that I finished in 2006. And for it to make sense, I'm going to just show you a few images with the work that I applied to graduate school with. And so I entered graduate school as a photographer, and I was making a body of work in America that consisted of people, places, and things that inspired a sense of wonder. And in my second summer at Bard, I came across this text by Edward Said called "On Amateurs and Professionals," and in it he basically challenges the kind of professionalization of the intellectual, and he says that by professionalizing oneself, it totally eliminates one's ability to follow your interest wherever they go. And for that reason, he really urges amateurs, and I feel like it applies as aptly to artists, to follow your kind of interest wherever they go and to kind of remain an amateur in that regard. And, you know, reading that kind of felt like a direct kind of indictment on the last several years of making photographs and creating a kind of very defined style and body of work. So it definitely kind of threw me, and I started thinking a lot about the history of photography and looking at it, and specifically at like artists like L'Artigue, who began making photographs, you know, when he was 6 years old, which is kind of like the definition, I don't know if you'd call it a definition of being an amateur when you're, you know, a child, but his interest in photography certainly kind of made me think about just allowing yourself to kind of follow these things that are exciting to a child. And in his case, it seemed to be kind of movement and the kind of the technologies of the day. And noticing these early flight pictures and just the total experimentation of them, it occurred to me that both these histories, photography and flight, were both pioneered by amateurs. So I started to look at, you know, some of these early flight photographs that the Wright brothers made at Kitty Hawk, and, you know, looking at both L'Artigue's work and looking at these amazing pictures of the Wright brothers that were taken, you know, within 10 years of each other, I felt this kind of palpable sense of discovery in the work, and realized that I wanted to make work about this, and I wanted to feel this in my work. So this brings me back to kind of Sublunar, and although, you know, I can't make myself an amateur, I can't push myself back into an amateur aviationist, it didn't make sense to kind of reinvent the wheel in a way. So instead, you know, I began making the pictures at night because of the kind of necessity of lighting them and the implied kind of theatricality of these night photographs. And all of these pictures kind of involve a kind of magic or alchemy in which there's a transformation that these characters kind of want to happen, in which these base substances like or normal things like balloons and leaf blowers and, you know, paper airplanes somehow at night through some sort of mysterious thing become some way to access this kind of this like levitation or weightlessness or something that's bigger than themselves. And part of this project involved building stuff and building things that had to work or that I felt had to work. And even though all these things are set up for a photograph that has to exist in, you know, just for a, you know, 125th of a second, and is immediately coming right back down to earth, there are all these kind of fictive moments of the arc of that, of whatever's being launched. It was still really important for me to make sure that the things that I made could actually happen, that we could actually launch this life-size dummy of myself to this, you know, to this height, using, you know, a makeshift field goal. I wanted to start with this project because there are two videos from Sublunar that I'm still really, I feel still very much kind of express what interests me about making art. And, you know, in a video as opposed to a still, at least in my experience in graduate school, what was so exciting, and it still is that, you know, the chance moments and the things that happen in front of a camera, they exist in both cases, but in a video often, it's just continuously run. So things just develop organically, and in each take in that way seems much more precious because it's just so unlikely that things will continue to proceed in a way that you want or that you couldn't expect but turns out in something that you like. So I'm just going to show this video. It's called Levitation Exercise, and I'll tell you a few more things about it afterwards. Do you actually mind turning lights down a little bit more? So what I loved about this piece and what I still do is that kind of very, and you can, I don't need these on me either. You can just, is it these very, this super simple act, you know, taking a big balloon and just pushing it up into the air and following it with the spotlight, how that totally mundane and easy in a way, performative gesture can turn into more of a kind of transformative mythic story in a way that like it felt it felt like it could be a story about a man kind of holding up the moon, you know, and having to, and that being his punishment, obviously in relationship to, you know, existing myths like Sisyphus or that of Atlas. And then the other obvious thing that exists in this is just the two forces that are in play, the kind of the force of gravity that just kind of slowly pushes this thing back down on me and me just running through the field trying to keep up with it. In a way that's like what I'm still making work about, and it kind of takes different forms, but that kind of tension is the thing that I think I'm really interested in. The next video I'm going to show you doesn't take place at night, and it takes place in a very recognizable place. It's called Monument Valley Flight Attempt, and you know, unlike the nighttime fantasies, this, you know, occurs under this kind of scrutinizing light of day, in which there's no kind of room for fantasy. And in both of these videos, the experiment was kind of real. In this one, it's you know, less successful from the point of view of what I was kind of hoping would happen, but equally real. And that was kind of that was just an exciting thing to see how a failure could generate a kind of new, I don't know, something that I was still interested in. Let me just show you this, and I'll say a few more things afterwards. I love that last hands on the hips, like, how am I going to get my plane back? I wanted to show this picture in relationship to this this piece, because it's a painting by Caspar David Friedrich. I'm sure some of you know it. It's a super famous painting of, you know, a monk by the sea that's often used as an example, or the example of kind of the sublime and how it was used in 19th century painting. And you know, I always liked the theme of the sublime, this kind of terrifying form of nature. But in this painting, you know, he kind of pushes the viewer into accessing it through this kind of contemplative space of a monk or a cloaked figure that's interpreted to be a monk. And what I did in Monument Valley Flight Attempt, without necessarily realizing it, was that, you know, Monument Valley is this epic place that, you know, is used for John Wayne films, and it has both this physical and metaphysical potential. The physical potential is obviously this 100-foot cliff, but the metaphysical potential is the sublime that that I hope, or this character hopes, will somehow rub off on this on this endeavor of you know, throwing this giant paper airplane off this giant cliff. And the idea of trying to tap into nature and have it kind of have it give something back to the activities of an individual is something that actually still exists in this show that I have up at Marty's now, and I'll get to that in a second. But the other reference is, of course, Wile E. Coyote, and I'm sure you all know his annex and, you know, his stuff from Roadrunner. But the thing I love about Wile E. Coyote is that he's kind of eternal. He is an eternal optimist. You know, regardless of how badly he fails, he kind of always comes back with another scheme, and he always believes himself to be this super genius. And it makes his failures that much more funny, but also this kind of mix of humor and this kind of sweet tragedy that I, you know, so I like to keep, you know, Caspar David Friedrich and Wile E. Coyote in my mind at all times. This is the last video I made at Bard, and it kind of began a new body of work, one focused more on kind of on masculinity and myths that are maybe more recognizable. And I'll say a little bit about it afterwards, but it's called William Tell, and well, I'll just say it now. And it's basically a reenactment of the famous story, but in a closed loop system where instead of there being two characters, you know, the son and William Tell, and having to perform this perfect action that neither kills him with his own arrow or misses the apple and then sentences them both to death, this character is attempting to kind of reenact this with just like himself. So I'm not gonna make you watch the whole thing right now. It goes on for a little bit longer, and there's more kind of slapstick thing. In the end, if it's not obvious to you, since I haven't shown the kind of reverse shot, but I'm shooting at a piece of polished granite, and the ricocheting BB is the thing that's trying to knock off the can. So at the end, you know, I do manage to knock this can off my head, and there's this kind of momentary celebration that, you know, no one, of course, sees, and it's kind of, you know, it's somewhat of a tragic thing because ultimately all of these symbols of masculinity, the gun, the armor, they're all indicators of his vulnerability. That you know, he's going to kind of wear all this stuff to protect him from a BB that isn't really that powerful, and he's not using a real gun. It's a toy gun, or it's a BB gun, which is close to being a toy. So the next video I'm going to show you is called Vital Capacity, and this is the first video I made out of grad school that I still am really excited about. And vital capacity is a medical term. It refers to the maximum amount of volume that you can exhale in a single breath. And you know, I love the idea of our bodies being kind of units of measurement and units of force. And in this video, it's again this kind of reenactment of levitation exercises again, and you'll see it. Thank you. That's like my favorite part of that video. Again, this is another kind of reenactment of the Sisyphean endeavor. And again, the symbols of masculinity, the mask, the helmet, turn into kind of the thing that causes, the thing that's supposed to be defending you and ends up being the thing that causes the trauma. So in reaction to that, in reaction to total struggle, which goes on for another 5 minutes, by the way, and I don't win, I made a video called Emerge that where the same forces are involved, but I'm kind of not in it, and the piece ends up being kind of about effortlessness instead of this kind of total struggle. And it ends up being this kind of deistic system, which once set in motion kind of can just kind of go. So it's about a 2-minute loop, and it kind of goes back into itself. So those three videos, you know, Vital Capacity, Emerge, and William Tell, I kind of pushed those all into a series that I worked on for 2 years called Actions. And I mentioned them because there's the kind of deistic systems that exists without me, the kind of human struggle that kind of doesn't yield any results, and the kind of moments of these kind of mock heroic masculine triumphs. And I shot, I'm going to show you 4 of 33 short videos. You may have seen this if you went to Marty Walker Gallery last September, where I showed this work. I think I'm just going to say that this will go like 3 minutes or so. That might have a special meaning for Texans. I don't know. But. So I'll just say a few things about, you know, what I was thinking about. And it should be obvious that so much of this project, you know, depended on experimentation and chance and trying things that might work once and then, you know, never happen again. And that was kind of part of what made it so much fun. And I felt like I'd, using this single kind of white background, I could use my studio as just a makeshift laboratory and try ideas until I basically didn't have any more, and that kind of, you know, completed the project, or where the next thing was just a more interesting transition. And I'll say one thing about, people sometimes ask me about, you know, why balloons, and balloons are, well, they're great because they're cheap. They kind of signify playfulness and youth, but they also have a kind of finite number of possible things that can happen to them. You know, they can really only explode or deflate or float away. And as a result, it just pares it down to this very limited number of possibilities. And I think that, you know, the whole project kind of works within a limited number of possibilities and a limited number of forces. And how I kind of combine those is where, and in what combinations is where kind of something interesting and where some tension can kind of exist. You know, while working on Actions, almost the exact same period of time, I started another project called Interventions. And I like to kind of work with a couple things in the air at once, and I like to have one that is somewhat more serious and somewhat where the parameters are somewhat more defined, and then one where it's more like play. And this was the play one, obviously, or not obviously, but I started it in Berlin when I didn't have a studio and I didn't have a lot of other materials to work with. And I basically just wanted to kind of start working with color, since I'd been in a white studio for so long. And I continued it, you know, in Brooklyn around my studio, just biking around looking for things to work with. And a lot of the forces that are at play in Actions are at play here, and vice versa. And this project often gave me ideas that I could take back into the studio. It also led me to kind of the next project, since I was out in the landscape kind of looking all the time. You know, I kind of started to pay more attention to things that I would see in Brooklyn and think about things that I could engage with in a way. And I'm sure, I mean, these hanging shoes are like all over the world. In Buenos Aires, I saw hanging shoes. You know, I feel like this happens all over the place, and there's no set definitive explanation. There's no single explanation of why they occur. There are lots of different ones. And the thing, I mean, drugs are for sale, someone was killed, they're a bully. There's like all these different, you know, there's all these different explanations. But the thing that I liked about it is that I could never really be sure why any individual threw up those pair of shoes. The only thing I knew is that they were thrown up there, and that action is in some way still visible and is still kind of in limbo. And I felt that since this person had kind of put them back into the landscape, they were up for grabs. And if I could come up with a way to kind of engage with these, then that would be interesting. I would have this kind of collaborator who I never met or would meet, and probably they would never notice the thing that I was going to do. So this is called Hunt and Gather. I finished it in 2008, and I'm just going to show you a few minutes of it. So part of what was so much fun about this project was that kind of the act of going out with a bow and arrow at dawn with box cutter blades on it and cutting down shoes and then trading them and hoping that, you know, I wouldn't, like, kill anybody or have anyone stop me for doing this, was that it felt in some ways similar to the urban legend quality of the reasons for why these shoes were there to begin with. And I kind of liked that idea that, you know, not that I would go on Wikipedia and say, oh, another reason for why these are here is that, you know, there's this guy who goes and does this thing, but there is an element to which that could be said. There could be a legend of, like, maybe these are how these shoes got here. And I kind of like that it kind of worked with a kind of urban mythology that it doesn't exist now and probably never will, or of course will never will, because I'm not going to go out and push that. But I like that it could, in a way. The left-hand take is just a single continuous tracking shot that I felt was necessary to kind of connect these spaces. So I'll just show you a few installation shots and tell you about one other piece that's part of this project. On the right-hand side of the wall there, which you might not notice if you walk in the gallery, is this piece, and it's called Constellation, and it is basically a way to try and make visible all of these otherwise invisible marks. Because the series, if it wasn't totally obvious, is I would cut down shoes, I would put the shoes that I cut down on, and I would trade the ones that I was wearing. And then I would take those shoes to another location. So essentially this entire array, I create this array of kind of invisible marks that basically no one would ever notice. Even if you paid really close attention, you probably wouldn't notice these shoes changing. And I like that as a really, really minimalist gesture in the landscape. But I also wanted to kind of make something that could kind of make a map or a legend of all these locations. So the upper right-hand corner is Greenpoint, Brooklyn. The bottom left-hand corner is Red Hook. I showed this at Pierogi Gallery in Brooklyn in May, and for the duration of the show, we locked the bike up outside. And like that leaning board in the room, which most people probably didn't notice, this bike would get passed. But I also like the idea that somebody who did notice that, there would be this other moment of discovery of seeing how this thing existed in the world and in the piece. Okay, this is somewhat personal, but people often ask artists where they get their ideas, and I think this was probably one of the things they liked the least. And when somebody sent me, or when one of my relatives sent me this picture of my great grandparents in their backyard in Exeter doing archery, I thought that I could always now just say it's part of my family, or it's genetic, or something like that. The new project that I made this year while traveling in Chile, in Uruguay, and Argentina is called Automatic. And as Terry said, it's up at Marty's Gallery right now in Dallas. And I'm not going to show you the whole thing, both because of time and because I want you to go see it. I'll tell you just a bit about kind of where it came from. The first place I went to when I was in Uruguay was this farm. At all times the wind would turn this windmill and make this sound, this constant clang that would pump water to the farm that we were on. And, you know, windmills are in some way like a symbol of hope, especially now as they take on this kind of environmental cause. But even, you know, for the last 1500 years, people have used them, to kind of turn natural energy into electricity or pumping water or milling corn or whatever grains that they would use to mill. And I wanted a way to kind of both intervene with the natural force that was present in this landscape, but also this symbol of kind of ingenuity, of human ingenuity. I don't know if any of you saw this story about this guy in Malawi who made these homemade windmills from looking at a picture in a book, but you should just Google Malawi man. His name's William. His name's William. I don't remember his last name, but I remembered that part. But anyways, this idea of kind of hopefulness about this innovative object I really liked. So I wanted to make something out of it. How could an artist use the natural forces, and how could I use that in a way? Like, people talk about conserving energy or not using fossil fuels. I'm like, how would an artist use a natural force to do his work for him, to conserve my own energies? Well, what would that even mean? So I made a drawing machine out of it, and this is a little video that will show you how it worked. So it's pretty hard to see these drawings on this projector, but what was so kind of interesting about making the machine and kind of changing the amount of water in the bottle and just constructing the basic parameters for how this would work was watching these first few drawings happen and seeing kind of this emergence of pattern and order that would develop that felt you know exactly like some sort of organic development. You know, I would let each drawing run for about 3 hours, varying the amount of water depending upon how much wind was laterally blowing. And again, there was always that kind of need to find this balance between something that would be heavy enough to make the mark, but not so heavy that the lateral wind couldn't kind of move it around a little bit. The last part of this project I made in Chile, and I was lucky enough to stay in a place that kind of exactly fit this concept that I was looking for. And I'll just show you this and talk to you a bit about it afterwards. So it's kind of hard to see, but the machine moves because I've connected fishing line to different water bottles that you can kind of see hanging there. And as the, you know, as the swells come up and move them, they fall in and out of this kind of state of equilibrium. And what was kind of most exciting about this project was A, finding this location that, you know, again, was literally up on this cliff. Overlooking this totally raw force that always surprised me when I would go up to the house and come back down or leave it up overnight, that it just wasn't swept away the next day. And that kind of total fragility and vulnerability of this little mechanism, and the fact that I would leave it and it would just keep running, I found just really, I don't know, moving in a way. And in that same way, I felt that it related to that Monument Valley flight attempt, where instead of just trying to absorb the sublime, that this was actually kind of making a record of it. And, you know, God, these are hard to see, but, you know, it's both a record of time, but I felt like it was also kind of like a field recording that, you know, my, like, experimental audio people, friends of mine will do and work with. It was like a different way to kind of record the activity of a certain place. So, coming home from this project and thinking about making these drawings that could essentially be made, could be just made like continuously while the ocean or any form of energy is working, and thinking about having a show of this work, I wanted in some way to bring that into a gallery, but also to use the gallery space and the dynamics there and kind of subvert them and play with them and use the audience as well as kind of a source of energy. So this is a little video that shows this installation called Work and Trade at Pierogi in Brooklyn in May. And actually there's a video up at Marty's that I didn't show, but it's also with a ceiling fan that was kind of the first drawing machine I made in Argentina and inspired the rest. But anyways, the parameters of the project were that I would use the ceiling fan and manipulate this balloon and the string and helium and use it to make drawings. And then I would let viewers come in for the first 10 days of the show and look through the drawings. And if they wanted one, they could have one as long as they traded me something that I didn't already have on the shelf. And their trade would then become a part of this work. And this interaction was really interesting because it's obviously much different than a gallery opening, and it's much different than a normal transaction that would happen in a gallery where someone with money gives them that money to take this work. And the value I found was the things that I was most interested in were the things that were most personal to people that couldn't kind of be placed a value on, yet they didn't feel like they needed in a way, but they wanted to be visible somewhere. So I made this little workshop using a lot of the same materials that I used in Chile and Argentina, you know, discarded plastic bottles and string and tape. And Pierogi's known for their flat file system. So artists can show the gallerist their work, and if he likes it, he'll put it in the flat files. And it's a really egalitarian way of allowing artists to access, to get their work out there. And so I used a similar system, and viewers would write down the thing that they're trading me, and I would photograph both the traded object and the drawing. And there were no signatures, it was just the date and time that it took to make the drawing. And the drawings were really more of a collaboration than the automatic series, in that you know, I would sometimes move the paper, change the pen. You know, it was really like, for me to remain interested in this, I had to kind of try to make different kinds of marks using the different materials I had. And then there's this kind of fun curatorial aspect of it, where, like I said, these personal objects, you know, I ended up putting them all on kind of one row and kind of all the stuff that I could tell people really didn't, you know, were basically trying. I mean, it was this interesting social experiment where people could give me, like, nothing, basically. They could give me, like, a pen top that I didn't have, or, like, a keychain ring that had fallen apart that was just, like, the minimal, minimal thing. Or people could actually, like, think, this is an interesting project. I want to give you something. I want to make the creative act, you know, and that was really kind of fun. You know, people like Kim Jones is this awesome artist, and he I was eating a slice of pizza, and he made me this really awesome pizza man drawing. And this other artist, you know, would trade me this like painstaking animation that she had worked on for a long time. And in that way, I feel like it became a repository for things that people valued and wanted to go out there into the world in some other place that might be visible, but they weren't. You know, they could part with them. Someone drew the bike ladder. This artist who works with signatures traded me this piece, and it to me in some ways represents the entire project. This entire collection is really just a collection of signatures. So in the end, the work and trade collection consisted of 285 unique trades. So I'm preparing for a show in New Haven that opens on November 10th. And part of the show, the curator invited me to propose something for this empty lot down the street from the gallery. And, you know, the first thing I noticed really upon entering the space was that there's a gravel court, and on opposite sides there were these unused or underused telephone poles. And it just seemed so clear that this should be a basketball court, since it both felt like a place that people might play pickup sports, and the poles were already there. So she liked the idea, and I had a residency, so I made this basketball hoop and backboard to the scale of those 25-foot poles. And I made it out of the stuff that you can find in New Haven, like, you know, rebar and pallet wood. You can find that stuff anywhere, but there's a lot of it there because of the kind of post-industrial, a lot of the remains of post-industrial New Haven. And you know, I installed it at McDowell just to test it out, 20 feet up, and the rim is about 43 inches across. And it's really hard to throw a basketball 20 feet into the air, and that's kind of the point of the project, is that it places you in a position of kind of vulnerability where you are faced with that sense of your own kind of physical potential. Like, there are a lot of people who just aren't strong enough to throw a basketball that high. And even people who are strong enough probably won't be able to do it on the first try. I played a game of, I think, like, not even horse. It was like a three-letter basketball, whatever, you know, it was like top or something. And it took forever because it's really hard to do. And that's like a very humbling thing. But to me, it kind of brings me back to the moment when I was like 10 and I couldn't quite, or I was just able to be able to make a basket on a regular size 10-foot hoop. And that to me is like an interesting moment of to kind of remember that, and also to reenact that physical that moment of limitation. Here is some really ugly basketball that we did at the opening. It's like a little game of 3-on-3 that we played. I apologize in advance. Pretty fun, even though it was like our team lost, which is a little embarrassing. But so the last project I'm going to show you is something I'm still finishing for this show in New Haven, and it's called Time is Like the East River. And I made the boats at McDowell, and it's basically, you know, a standard 17-foot aluminum canoe that I cut in half and turned into two boats. And the idea originally came from the fact that the East River that runs through New York, because it's so close to the ocean, it actually changes directions three times a day with the tides. And, you know, I really, that surprised me. Like, I didn't know that. And that, to me, told me just how removed I was from the landscape. The landscape that, you know, I'd take a train to Manhattan every day, and you just were oblivious to this fact. And I wanted to do something with that fact that this thing changes directions, and in between changing directions, it actually stops for 20 minutes. And, like, thinking about that reality in relationship to the common conception or metaphor of time being like a river constantly flowing forward, there's just a wonderful problem there, you know, that it, what happens when it stops in that metaphor? What happens when it changes directions? And on top of that, you know, enacting this performance of these two boats kind of meeting in the middle of the river at that moment of slack tide and becoming a boat, becoming a single canoe again, to me is a way of kind of compressing this historical space and kind of going back to the Manhattan before Western people were there, when, you know, the Lenape tribe in dugout canoes navigated these waterways, and the total juxtaposition of this kind of modernized version of this dugout canoe, but in this same space. So I can't quite articulate exactly all the things that are going into this because I haven't quite figured them all out. But this photograph kind of is about that liminal space between you know, the horizon and between, or the horizon as a liminal space between, you know, the earth or the water and the sky, and between kind of history and the present, and these two forces and directions. And inherent to that is this this kind of moment of effort and repose, which is something that, again, I've come back to. So thank you so much for your time and for having me here. So, if you want to ask me questions, now's the time.
Was your paper plane made of paper?
The first one was. The picture of that first one was made of paper. But then at Monument Valley, I figured out that foam core was a lot easier and had structure. So. Yes?
What's the name of the gallery in Dallas?
In Dallas, Marty Walker Gallery. And it runs through November 14th. Yes?
How many structures do you go through? Do you find that you some are destructive before you achieve the drawing? Or what is your process like?
Somebody asked me a question a couple weeks ago about the idea of making models. And in that question, I felt that most of the things that I do, the model is the thing. And because of the way I like to work, generally the model will become the final result. And I just, because of the need to kind of execute this thing and to make it work on the spot, generally I'll make one thing and work with it until it either succeeds and it's done, or I kind of abandon it. There's not a lot of kind of going back and making it perfect. That's something when I stopped doing photographs, I felt like I wanted to get away from this idea of like a perfect, crisp photograph. It's free of dust or any of the things that, you know, get in the way of making that. And leaving that, I wanted to kind of not have that that kind of need to make a perfect thing in sculpture or anything else. So. As I said, I want to get away from making a perfect photograph. I think that it's easy to slip back into a mode of kind of composition and framing and making something that is just purely aesthetic. Whereas in the video, like I said earlier, like I think so much of it is about the kind of magic of each take and hoping that in those moments, in those performances, something unexpected happens that that continues and leads into an interesting space. So, for the most part, I feel like photography is kind of an execution of an idea, and video is a series of experiments, and performance, obviously, in that I'll do it until something interesting happens. At least in actions, that was definitely the case. Yes.
When you're riding around.
Believe it or not, in Williamsburg, nobody really asks questions, and there are far more like weird activities going on and like custom-made bike stuff that, you know, I remember seeing like a cruiser kind of go by, and you know, they're just like, as long as you're not stopping traffic, it's fine. And well, I wasn't shooting the bow and arrow at that moment, like, too, so. They're helium balloons, and there's a submarine underneath the water. No, there's just an apparatus. There's a little contraption that basically flips it from down to up, and as the balloons dry off, there's really no moment of balance. It just goes from sticking to off, and you know, when the helium becomes lighter than air and the water on it. And there are different amounts of helium in each balloon so that it wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't all just, like, take off immediately. They'd kind of linger there, so.
How deep?
That's actually in Brooklyn, and it's right off of Jamaica Bay. So at high tide, it's, like, you know, basically the height of this podium. So it's a perfect place to do it. But normally you can see across, actually, and we really got lucky with the fog that morning.
That's funny.
Right. Well, thankfully, with the technology is just amazing now. Like, I can use the same camera to make really beautiful HD video and photographs in the same like working mode. So it's, for me, it's really great now, and it's easy to do these things. So.
Why do you use yourself as the subject of most of your pictures?
I think part of it is just it's just easier to use yourself. I mean, it's one less person you have to call and. But actually it's also like, at least with the canoe thing, I didn't show you the video, but, you know, I was actually out in the East River and I had one other guy and it kind of was a problem because, if you're not behind the camera, then the camera work isn't going to be exactly, or you're not telling the person working the camera to work exactly, but if you're not in the boat, they're not doing that right. So I need to kind of delegate a little bit better and, you know, because honestly, like, I don't want to be in the picture as much. I want to be able to, like, when I don't have to be in the picture, I want to be able to just get people there. But unfortunately, that costs money, especially in New York. Like, even friends don't want to show up to, like, help you at 6 a.m. on the East River, you know? So, yeah. So using yourself is just a great starting point. Sorry, yes. Right.
Does that make sense?
Totally. And I think I fall more into, you know, this is a document that becomes the work. And there are some pieces that, I mean, I kind of use that word loosely because it communicates, I think people understand what I'm talking about until it comes down to that exact point. Is the performance the work or is it the document? Is that really the work? And I think for the most part, that's where photography, my background in photography, kind of takes over. Maybe more than I'm comfortable with sometimes, where I wish it could just be the performance, and that's okay. But since I kind of have a low tolerance for video work that just doesn't really hold my interest in a gallery, I kind of privilege the viewer, and I want them to like want to watch this, and I want what happens to be interesting. So I feel like the kind of the use of video is necessary because in an actual performance, it's really impossible to make that take the one that you want the audience to see. So in that sense, I feel like it definitely becomes, you know, something for the camera, and that is the work, the one that I selected, not just the one that happened to be. Does that make sense? Okay. Cool. Thank you, guys.